Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie reading the Big Bend Sentinel on October 29th, 2020. Martha's one ballot proposition will decide if city regains control of electric utility negotiations. By Abby Perot. Martha. Along with voting to fill three seats on Martha's City Council, residents will also find one proposition on the city ballot this year that will decide whether Martha will once again have a say in negotiating rates, operations, and services of electric utilities. The city ballot is not combined like the federal and county ones, so residents of Martha must head to a separate table in the USO building to pick up their Martha ballot. The proposition reads, "Shall the city of Martha reinstate its original jurisdiction over the rates, operations, and services of electric utilities within the city's municipal limits, so as to give the citizens of Martha a greater voice in issues affecting their electric service, and to provide fair, just, and reasonable rates in adequate and efficient electricity service within the city." This spring, council agreed to hire outside counsel from Lloyd Gosselink, attorneys at law, to get guidance on the upcoming AEP franchise agreement and a possible November ballot measure to take back the city's rate-making authority. Christopher Brewster, a lawyer at Lloyd Gosselink, presented to council about what the ballot proposition could mean for Martha. This week, Brewster said, the story begins at an unknown time. Some years ago, Martha, like many other municipalities, voted to turn over its power to negotiate rates with the local electric utilities. Martha is one of those instances where it happened so long ago, probably back in the 1970s, that no one I've spoken to knows for sure. I've not seen when it happened or how it happened, but my guess would be a very long time ago. Since then, rather than negotiating on their own behalf, the Public Utility Commission in Austin will do it for Martha, working directly with AEP to settle various issues. But for the first time, as far as Brewster and his colleagues can tell, a city is trying to wrest that power back into its own hands, and that requires a vote by the people of Martha. The reason the ballot proposition is up for consideration this election season. This would be a new thing in the utility landscape in Texas, Brewster told council. In fact, Martha could be a pilot for other areas in Texas who have given up their jurisdiction. We have thought in our office that, if it can be proven that it can be done, there may well be interest elsewhere in the state. What does the power of negotiation actually mean for a city? It's the benefit of local control, according to Brewster. Martha's City Council will have a greater say over rates and operation of AEP within the city limits of Martha, and that could come into play a number of ways. Martha will have a say about AEP's electric rates from the beginning of negotiations, even though utilities will often appeal decisions to the Public Utility Commission in Austin eventually. If Martha residents reject the ballot proposal, things will stay the way they are currently. Right now, AEP presents its case to all the cities that have retained their jurisdiction, and then also files the case at the PUC for all those areas that have either ceded jurisdiction or are in the rural areas where there is no city. Said Brewster, Martha falls in the latter category, but if the measure passes, it would join the cities who have jurisdiction, meaning AEP would have to state their case to Martha Council first. Once all the cities with jurisdiction rule on the case, typically AEP will appeal that ruling to the PUC, and the PUC bundles it all together and handles it in one case, Brewster said. Another outcome of rejecting the proposal is it would be one fewer item on the city council's plate to deal with, leaving it all up to the PUC to work on utility prices and negotiations. But many of the benefits of local control, should Martha vote to have it, come from the city being able to deal directly with AEP. The city would be able to have more of a say about any potential service quality issues, citizen complaints about electric utility service, or rate setting. One example given to the council this spring was that utilities companies often must trim trees in order to provide service, but oftentimes citizens aren't happy with how those trims happen, sometimes taking off more than necessary. Local control would give council more access to negotiating with AEP. Brewster said, ultimately, it is up to the voters to decide what role they, through their city government, are going to play in regulating electric utility service in the city. At latest workshop, Marfa focuses on details of short-term rental ordinance by Stephen Paulson. Marfa city leaders are sparing no details as they comb through their proposed short-term rental ordinance. City Council held the third workshop on this topic last week, clocking in at about 2 hours. Last week's meeting was almost exclusively attended by people who profit from short-term rentals, either as property owners or managers, and those residents once again pushed back on new regulations and warned they could have unforeseen impacts on Marfa's tourist economy. Last week, though, city officials also heard the perspective of a long-term renter. That resident, Claire Lindsay McGinn, said she'd come to support new rules on vacation rentals. "I make money in town, and finding a rental here is extremely hard," she said at the meeting. "There's a lack of housing in this town for people who live and work here." In a follow-up interview this week, Lindsay McGinn, who is a graphic designer at the Big Bend Sentinel and a small business owner, said she attended the meeting to make sure that renters have a voice in discussions of the new ordinance. "I went to the meeting because affordable housing is hard to find in Marfa," she said. "I don't know all the nuts and bolts of housing law, but I do know that being a renter here is really challenging. Short-term rentals, to me, are part of the problem." A lot about this new ordinance is still to be determined, but with hours of public discussions, a few hot-button issues have come up. As Marfa City Council gets ready for its next meeting on this issue tonight, Thursday, October 29th, here are some aspects of the proposed ordinance that have proven particularly contentious. The why. Even three meetings in, some local officials and residents are still unsure why exactly Marfa wants or needs a short-term rental ordinance. "What do we want out of this?" Councilmember Yosef Ben Yehuda asked at one point. "What do we hope for the results to be?" As the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported, Marfa city leaders have plenty of reasons to want new rules on short-term rentals, from rising housing prices and unpaid hot fees to unregistered rentals who flouted temporary bans during the start of the coronavirus crisis. But these workshops have left that question a little ambiguous. At the meetings, officials and residents have often focused on quality of life issues like noise complaints, for which Marfa already has ordinances. At this most recent meeting, some leaders were clear about the stakes. Mayor Manny Baeza pointed out that Marfa's population was falling. Councilmember Buck Johnston noted that the voter registration was down. "We have less voters," she said. Councilmember Natalie Melendez, meanwhile, said Marfa was becoming a town that's strictly comprised of part-time residents and tourists. "This is something that every city that has tourism and has a high number of Airbnbs is grappling with," Melendez said. "This is not unique to our town." Ben Yehuda told the council he shared these concerns. "Businesses on Highland Street in the middle of Marfa," he noted, "were increasingly catering to tourists rather than residents. But between quality of life concerns, housing costs, and permitting, Ben Yehuda thought City Council was trying to address too many problems at once. I don't want everything to get grouped into the short-term rental ordinance," he said. Melendez disagreed. "You can't think of these things as being separate," she said. "They are all intertwined. Besides, as she saw it, the new proposed rules for vacation rentals in Marfa were pretty light and not aggressive in terms of regulation." Type 2 rentals. San Antonio's short-term rental ordinance, on which Marfa is loosely based, makes a distinction between different kinds of short-term rentals. Type 1 rentals are owned by people who live on the property but rent out spare rooms. Type 2 rentals are effectively a hotel business, with property owners renting out a whole house and living elsewhere, even in a different city or state. San Antonio city officials were particularly concerned with Type 2 rentals and imposed extra regulations on them, including a limitation on the proportion of the city block they can take up. Marfa city leaders are considering adopting a similar approach, including imposing that same block limit. Unsurprisingly, that's proving contentious for a few reasons. First, many owners of short-term rentals in Marfa do not live in the same property they rent out to vacationers. For these people, any new limits on Type 2 rentals could pose a threat to their bottom line. Throughout these workshops, city officials have stressed that they plan to grandfather existing rentals, allowing them to bypass certain regulations like density caps that would apply to later vacation rentals in the city. But it would probably be harder to open new ones. In the Zoom's chat box, some rental owners wondered why they would be allowed to continue operating a Type 2 rental if for any reason their permitting lapsed, and there was already a legal limit. Such rules would also set a theoretical limit on how many Type 2 rentals could exist in Marfa. If every block reached its maximum limit of Type 2 rentals, no one else would be able to open one. Robert Spiegel, a short-time rental owner, called it very dangerous and a slippery slope to set up rules like this without first considering the impacts on Marfa's tourist economy. In a big city like San Antonio, he noted, there could be more than 20 houses on a single block. Marfa blocks were smaller. I just really, really want this to be something that helps rather than hinders, Spiegel said. But last but not least, there's still confusion on exactly how Marfa will define Type 1 and Type 2. Take, for example, a resident who claims a homestead exemption on their Marfa home, but rents it out for up to half the year. Which type would they be? It isn't clear. Though city officials appeared to lean towards Type 1 at the last meeting. Making things more confusing, Marfa city officials have so far declined these rental types in two separate ways. In discussions, they frequently use the same distinctions as San Antonio, describing Type 1 as owner-occupied and Type 2 as not. The written ordinance uses other distinctions, with Type 2 rentals in R1, single-family zoned areas, and Type 1 in other zones, like commercial districts. But those two definitions are inconsistent, and at press time, city officials were still figuring out which definition to use. Local contacts. According to the current draft of the ordinance, all short-time rentals must have a local contact person who can be on-site within 30 minutes to handle all guest issues. At least judging by the Zoom text chat, this is one of the more controversial aspects of the current ordinance, with many people describing this rule as an unfair burden on short-term rental owners. One rental owner, Lorna Leedy, suggested the city officials instead require people to respond in a reasonable amount of time. A rental manager, Yana Friedman, said, "Accountability to guests is regulated by platforms like Airbnb and does not need to be regulated by the city. In 16 years, I've never needed to be at a rental in 1 hour," Spiegel wrote. "Never. This is absurd." Councilmember Johnston, who herself runs a short-term rental, said she already felt obligated to respond quickly to any guest concerns, but she thought the city should require contacts to respond quickly rather than be on site. "I don't feel comfortable going on site where there are guests," she said. "It's their private space." Privacy was another concern. If the local contact person had to respond to complaints by neighboring residents and not just guests, that would likely require the city to publicize those phone numbers. Councilmember Ben Yehuda said he was not comfortable with that. "We are spending money on host compliance to field complaints," he noted. That was one of their pitches. Elisa Costa, a representative for the company who was on the call, agreed host compliance could handle those complaints. She suggested city leaders publicize the host compliance number as a community resource, which she said would provide two benefits. Not only could the company handle some of the complaints, but it would also create a streamlined database of complaints that city leaders could then take action on. The next meeting on this ordinance is the regular council meeting today, Thursday, October 29th at 6 p.m. Zoom details are available on the City of Marfa website. Disclosure. As mentioned above, Claire Lindsay McGinn is an employee of the Big Bend Sentinel. Her opinions on this issue did not influence our reporting. Organized to celebrate democracy with Election Day Barbecue by Stephen Paulson. Marfa. Earlier this year, Presidio County was facing abysmal census response rates of just around 25%. So some local organizations, including the Judd Foundation and Marfa Steps Up, made a deal with Tri-County residents. If they filled out and returned the 2020 census, they'd get enrolled in a raffle where they could win burritos, ice cream, and more. The initiative was a success, and Shelley Bernstein, an organizer at Marfa Steps Up, started wondering if she could do something similar for the other big civic event of the year, the 2020 elections. "I'm not going to say we had a huge needle move," Bernstein said of the census efforts, "but we do think we had an impact." By organizing a similar push around voting, Bernstein hoped to reaffirm that local residents really care about civic participation. Bernstein and Marfa Steps Up, the organization she helped found, have played a big role in keeping Marfans afloat during the coronavirus crisis. Earlier this year, as the crisis was just beginning, the group raised more than $35,000 to help local service industry workers, many of whom found themselves out of work as restaurants and bars across the region and county closed. Later, Bernstein also helped start the Marfa Solidarity Bonds Project, which allows residents to buy local artist-designed bonds to help struggling restaurants. That project ultimately raised more than $85,000 for local businesses and was, as the Big Bend Sentinel reported in July, arguably a win-win-win. Local artists got to share their work, Marfans got to take home cool artwork, and local restaurants got a helping hand in a time of need. Now in Marfa Steps Up's latest service for the community, there's an Election Day barbecue. In an interview this week, Bernstein said she hoped the barbecue would address two problems. For one thing, getting a free barbecue plate lunch could help create a good experience around voting, especially for first-time voters, and especially at a time when some Texans are wary of heading to the polls for fear of getting sick. On top of that, Bernstein pointed out that food insecurity is also a growing problem across the country. She cited a recent article in the New York Times, which reported that as many as 1 in 8 Americans now face food insecurity. That figure is even higher in rural communities, she said. Meanwhile, in Marfa, demand is up at the local food pantry. Food deliveries are now coming twice as often. I started to look at those problems and put it together with the civic participation equation, Bernstein said. That led her to the idea of an Election Day barbecue. The barbecue has several local sponsors, including the Judd Foundation, Community Marfa, Ballroom Marfa, KMKB Radio, and the Sentinel. Convenience West is cooking. The event runs on Election Day, Tuesday, November 3rd, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., or while supplies last. It'll be at the Marfa Bank parking lot, just across the street from the polling site at the USO building. Masks and social distancing are required, but Bernstein stressed, voting on Election Day isn't. People who voted earlier are also welcome to come get barbecue, she said. No matter when you vote, your voice matters, Bernstein added. Come celebrate that with free barbecue. When the event is over, leftovers, if there are any, will be sent to the Marfa Nutrition Center, where they'll be distributed to seniors. In an interview this week, Mark Scott, a co-owner at Convenience West, said Bernstein first approached him about the idea a few weeks ago. He was sold. It seemed like an exciting way to be a part of things, Scott said. We always like to help out with good causes like this. In more normal times, Scott added, Convenience West would like to be on the road, cooking at barbecue events. In February, for example, they cooked for a Judd Foundation fundraiser in Manhattan. Now big travels like that are largely out of the question. We get to take our smoker to the bank parking lot, Scott joked. I guess that's our big road gig. Scott wouldn't say much about what he was serving. He was still ironing out the details, other than to say it would be a pretty killer sandwich. Convenience West was previously part of the Marfa Solidarity Bonds Project. Bernstein, Scott said, had knocked that project so far out of the park that the experience gave him confidence that she should organize a great Election Day barbecue. When a bunch of nice people ask you to be a part of something, why wouldn't you want to be, he said. We're excited about the barbecue and to see what the buzz is like. Hopefully it'll be kind of a scene, but a safe one at that. With Election Day still around a week away, turnout from early voting is already smashing records in Texas and beyond. But this election has also seen problems already, as state leaders in Texas and elsewhere have enacted rules that many see as blatant attempts at voter suppression. In Texas, for example, Governor Greg Abbott and others have fought hard in court to restrict who can vote by mail and limit how many ballot drop-off boxes a county can have. In Presidio County, Bernstein stressed the way she was pleased with how local officials were handling this election. The county has been, I think, really, really, really responsive and efficient, she said. I think there's a difference between what's happening in the rest of Texas and what's happening here. Still, with the 2020 election seeing unprecedented levels of voter interest during an unprecedented crisis, Bernstein wanted to help that process along. Her hope is for voting in Marfa to not just be easy, but also fun. I think the more we can do this kind of thing, the better experience we can create around voting, the more people might want to do it in the future, she said. That'd be my hope. Ballroom resident Rob Fry shares the magic and beauty of West Texas birds by Abby Perot. Marfa. Refrigerators hum, clocks tick, birds chirp, and then inevitably humans tune out the persistent noise until it hardly exists at all. But musician, birder, and recent Ballroom Marfa resident Rob Fry wants to tune people back into the melodies of local birds, and his latest album, Chihuahuan Desert Birdscapes, is an invitation for locals to begin to hear again. The album itself relies on Fry's field recordings from the area and his own improvised instruments from invasive grasses found on the border, along with audio contributions from Zeno Canto, a site where citizen scientists upload birdsong recordings. The artist is a trained musician, but also spent 3 seasons as a field biologist, counting birds by ear in California. One of my goals with the project is to make people more aware of their environment. It's so vast. It's easy to look over the whole thing, said Fry. For some reason, the general public thinks bird watching is over your head or for dorks. But Fry is passionate about helping people begin to see with fresh eyes these creatures that have evolved intricately over millions of years. We really should pay attention to them and stop pretending that we can't understand or stop overlooking it. It's not like people are deliberately not paying attention, but it's one of those things that's subtle. My job as a musician and bird watcher is to show them the magic and beauty of the hidden stuff. In the album, Fry made a point to sample endangered birds in the area, wanting to make sure to capture some of the unique threatened species in the area, but also highlight what we share, he said. From his home in Chicago, he discussed eastern meadowlark ranges, which span from his area all the way to West Texas. Alongside the Ballroom commissioned album, Fry has presented a Hearing Hidden Melodies lecture organized with the Chihuahuan Desert Research Institute in Fort Davis. Listen to the lecture first, Fry suggested. He admitted he's the type to read the plaques when visiting museums and hopes the lecture enlightens subsequent listens to the album in the same way. Their sounds are just insanely cool to me as a musician, and when you slow it down, you can hear it, he added. We have to really appreciate it. The lecture is available through November 1st on Ballroom Marfa's website, and the album is available on Ballroom Marfa's Bandcamp.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, October 22nd. Fort Stockton Man Dies in Head-On Collision by Nathan Hewer. A 37-year-old male from Fort Stockton died in a head-on collision early Tuesday morning on State Highway 115, 2 miles north of Kermit. The victim has been identified as Jose Grado Dominguez. According to the Texas Department of Safety preliminary investigation, Grado Dominguez was driving a 2017 Chevrolet Camaro south on State Highway 115, when he entered the northbound lane and collided with a 2007 International Truck tractor hauling a semi-trailer at 1:48 a.m. on Tuesday, October 20th. Grado Dominguez was pronounced dead on the scene. The driver of the semi, Adolfo Sanchez Hurado, 49, of Fabens, Texas, was not injured. The road conditions were dry and the weather was clear. The crash is still under investigation. 2 Pecos County Sheriff's vehicles totaled in pursuit by Nathan Hewer. The Pecos County Commissioner's Court decided at their regular meeting on October 13th to approve the replacement of 2 Pecos County Sheriff's Office vehicles that were totaled in a pursuit on September 19th around 11 a.m. According to Pecos County Chief Deputy T.J. Perkins, a deputy pulled over the suspect at the 310 mile marker. He stepped out of his vehicle before becoming uncooperative. The suspect drove off and got on Highway 290 towards Sheffield, where he came to a complete stop. One of the deputies then got out of his vehicle before the suspect backed up into the sheriff's vehicle. The other deputy then chased after the suspect down a dirt road before he put it in reverse once again, causing a collision to the side of the second sheriff's vehicle. Neither deputy was hurt in the incident. The suspect later rolled his vehicle later on down the dirt road and taken to the hospital in Ira Ann. The charges are going to happen in Crockett County, according to Perkins. A Ford Expedition and a Chevy Tahoe were totaled in a pursuit. The vehicle replacements will end up costing the county $67,780.63 after insurance reimbursement of approximately $30,000. COVID-19. Two additional deaths and nursing home outbreak confirmed in Pecos County by Nathan Heuer. Pecos County officials confirmed two additional Pecos County residents passed away due to COVID-19-related issues on October 17th at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. One resident was a 94-year-old female who was hospitalized on September 29th at Pecos County Memorial Hospital. The second patient was an 80-year-old male who was hospitalized on September 30th at PCMH. The two fatalities bring the death total to 8 in Pecos County since the start of the pandemic, and is the first death since August 15th, exactly 9 weeks prior to Saturday's fatalities. Despite the two deaths, active case numbers in Pecos County reached 22 on Monday, October 19th, the lowest active case number since September 29th. That number drastically changed on Tuesday, October 20th, as an outbreak was reported at the Pecos County Nursing Home in Fort Stockton. 14 residents of the nursing home tested positive. 4 of those residents were hospitalized as of October 20th, 3 at PCMH and 1 at MCH. With 4 additional positive tests on top of the nursing home outbreak in Tuesday's report, the active case number is at 40 as of Tuesday, the highest number of active cases since October 12th. From October 13th to October 21st, there has been 40 new positive tests and 31 recoveries. Since the start of the pandemic, there has been 349 positive tests in Pecos County with 301 recoveries. A total of 2,385 have been tested, with 1,925 coming back negative, 80.7%. There are 25 results pending as of October 20th. To see more info on COVID-19 updates in the county, watch the weekly COVID update with Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster and Fort Stockton Mayor Chris Williams on the Fort Stockton Pioneers Facebook live stream every Thursday. Obituaries and death notice from the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday. Robert Bob Hance Jensen passed away on October 14th. Bob was born December 20th, 1935. He was born 5 minutes before his identical twin brother, Rob. Their mother passed away during childbirth, and they were raised by their mother's identical twin sister and her husband. In 1955, while in Lubbock at Texas Tech, he met the love of his life, Arlita Black. They fell in love and were married on December 29, 1955, in Anton, Texas. Bob lost Arlita in 2004 to ALS. Bob leaves behind a sister-in-law, Jimmy Jensen, daughter Sandy Hill and her husband Mark, daughter Delise Henry Gravo and her husband Sean, grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. Bob was an active uncle to his 19 nieces and nephews, many great and great-great-grandnieces and nephews. Donations in Bob's memory can be made to Midland Children's Rehab in honor of Grant Robert Mata. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Guadalupe Gutierrez Velasquez, 93, of Fort Stockton, passed away on October 16th. A visitation was held 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Monday, October 19th, at the branch at NPW. Rosary was held Tuesday, October 20th, at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish, St. Joseph Church. Lupe was born on July 22nd, 1927, in Fort Stockton, to Pedro and Maria Gutierrez. Lupe is survived by her children, Emma Valenzuela, Velia Vargas, Francis Livingston, Dora Nunez, Gloria Velasquez, Cipriano Velasquez Jr., Luis Velasquez, Hope Fuentes, Tony Velasquez, Joanne Rodriguez, Ann Sosa, Kim Gonzalez, Mary Lou Bourgeois, Alex Velasquez, and Cindy Boggs. Her grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. Lupi is preceded in death by her husband, Cipriano Velasquez. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Roberto Garcia passed away on October 16th at the age of 80. He was born August 11th, 1940, and was a resident of Fort Stockton. A rosary was held at Our Lady of Guadalupe, downtown campus, Fort Stockton, on October 21st, with a mass and burial following at the Catholic Cemetery in Fort Stockton.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading for the Monahan's News for Thursday, October 22nd. Second family joins fight against school dress code. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Quote, I wish I would have never cut my son's hair. I wish I had known there was another option, Desiree Valle said. Valle, a parent of a Sudirth Elementary fourth grader, is speaking out over what she believes to be discriminatory dress and grooming codes at MWP-ISD targeting her son. Valle said she first found out the school had an issue with her son's hair length in early September. The 9-year-old's hair is shaved short on both sides and is grown out on top. The hair on top lays over to the side and comes to the bottom of the jawline, Valle said. Quote, he was coming home every day telling me school personnel would tell him he needed to get his hair cut or he would receive detention, ISS, in-school suspension, or possibly be suspended from in-person classes, Boyer said. Then on September 24th, Sudirth Elementary Assistant Principal Amy Strickland called Boyer, telling her she needed to cut her son's hair because he was out of compliance with the dress code. Strickland asked Valle if her son was Native American or if his hair was being kept long for religious reasons, and Valle explained it was actually both. Quote, Mrs. Strickland told me the only way my son could keep his hair long was if I proved he was Native American or with a letter from the family's religious leader, but said I would still have to get approval from the superintendent, she said. Since she didn't have an official document proving her son's Native American lineage, Valle provided a letter from her mother-in-law, who serves as the family's religious leader, explaining the hair blessing ceremony, but the school still denied that the letter qualified as proof with no explanation as to why. Quote, the principal, Kim Thomas, called me and said I still had to cut his hair and that the letter from my mother-in-law that I submitted would not qualify as proof. I asked her why, and she said I would have to talk to Mr. Smith, superintendent of schools Chad Smith, Valle said. After Valle's request to not cut her son's hair was denied at the campus level, she called Smith to discuss the issue. Quote, I did not receive any real resolution after talking to Mr. Smith. It seems to me they care more about my son's hair and following the sexist and homophobic rules than him being in class and getting an education, Valle said. Wanting to go a step further, Valle said she asked Smith, quote, who the school board members were and how she could get a hold of them. To which Smith replied, I don't know, Valle said. According to Smith, quote, The mention of the school board members never came up in my conversation with Mrs. Valle. All that was discussed was her son's father and grandmother was Native, but they still have to follow the dress code and policies, end quote. Smith added, quote, MWPISD faculty and staff are working every day to educate kids to the best of our ability. At the same time, we are enforcing our dress code policy as it is currently written. We will continue to work with and contact parents when issues arise. Let it be known that MWPISD has the best interest of every child at heart while teaching reading, writing, and math, and instilling values that will help them to become future productive citizens, end quote. Valle did get the names of MWPISD school board members and sent an email to President of the Board, Raymond Reyes. As of press time, Valle said she still has not received a response from Reyes. Quote, the general consensus of the conversation with Smith was I still have to cut his hair, she said. So, about an hour after the call with Smith, Valle did just that. Quote, my son cried the whole time, and I was very angry. I took a picture of my son crying while I was cutting his hair and sent it to Mr. Smith, Mrs. Thomas, and Mrs. Strickland, she said. Quote, I did use profanity in the email, but I was upset and frustrated with the whole situation and just couldn't believe it was happening, Valle said. The next day, Chief of Police for MWPISD, Orlando Orona, showed up at Valle's door. Quote, the first thing my son said when he saw an officer at the door was, are you here to arrest my mom or me? End quote. According to Valle, Orona told her he was at her home because of the email she sent to Mr. Smith and to Sudarth, and said Valle would be banned from campus if she didn't stop the hair issue. According to local attorney Alan Nicholas, using profanity in public or saying anything that would offend anyone in public is not a misdemeanor. It would actually have to be a threat to public health in order to be considered a criminal act. Valle felt like Chief Orona had threatened her, and so she just let it go. Quote, I did feel threatened, and I felt like I had to drop it, because if I didn't, my son would be bullied by school personnel, or I would eventually end up with charges against me, end quote. Chief Orona declined the opportunity to make a comment on his interaction with Valle. Valle and her family moved to Monahans in December 2019 from Arizona so the family could be together, since her husband was here working. Quote, we moved here from Tucson, so our children would see their dad more than 5 days a month. Valle has since begun the grievance process with the school district and against Chief Orona and filed a formal complaint to the Monahans Police Department against Chief Orona. A Level 1 grievance meeting with Mrs. Thomas is slated for October 21st. The date for the Level 1 grievance meeting with Chief Orona was not known as of press time. Rebecca Kynes, a parent of a Tatum Elementary first grader who was to be suspended from in-person instruction since she refused to get his shoulder-length hair cut, has recently filed an appeal to her Level 1 grievance response from Tatum Elementary Principal Jill Steen. Kynes filed a response on October 6th, and met with Smith on Tuesday, October 20th. Kynes told the news, quote, Mr. Smith said he contacted the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I will keep going and continue to pursue this until the school changes the policy, because this have never just been about my child, she added. A petition started on Facebook calling for the district to make changes to the hair and dress codes has received 878 signatures since its conception. MEDC Board approves intent to purchase two new properties. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Just managing to assemble a quorum, the Monahans Economic Development Corporation board members met for their regularly scheduled monthly meeting on Monday. After approving previous minutes, payables, and financials, the board considered agenda items, election of officers, buying and selling land on East Seeley Street, purchasing land on South Main Street, and a purchase order with Faulkner Consulting. Topping the list was to elect new officers for president, vice president, and secretary. The board elected Brian Franks for president, Richard Irwin for vice president, and Camilla Blum as secretary. In other business, the board considered the purchase of 3 lots from the city of Monahans on the north side of the block of West Seeley Street between Fay and Eva Streets. City council members voted last week in executive session to sell the lots to the MEDC for nearly $60,000, which is the appraised value from the city's insurance. According to MEDC Director Ashley Adato, quote, Dollar General has been looking into purchasing some land for a second location for a few months now, and the easiest way for them to do that was for the MEDC to purchase land first and then work with them to get the project going, end quote. Adato added, quote, They originally wanted a location on the north side of town, but we couldn't locate anything that would meet their needs. So this spot is as close to the north side and is more suitable for them, end quote. Dollar General will have to have the land under contract before they can submit it to their corporate for second site location approval. Quote, There is currently 2 other property owners for the remaining lots which are already under contract. They are just waiting on this part of the land to be under contract so they apply for a second site location and make the project work, she said. The new Dollar General will be located on the entire north side of the 600 block of West Seeley between Fay and Eva Streets. Going right along with the previous agenda item, board members considered the sale of the same 3 lots, which they just agreed to purchase from the city, to the Dollar General for an additional store. Quote, We've added in our buyback option, and they will have 12 months to lay slab from the closing date and 12 months for completion from date the slab is laid, but most likely they will be way ahead of this deadline, she said. The action was approved pending the purchase of the land from the city. In other actionable item, the board approved the purchase of 802 South Main. Quote, This is the trailer home, which is located right next to the lot purchased and cleared last December, Adato said. In December, the board purchased the corner lot located as of 8th and Main Streets, just south of the Main Street Cafe, for $160,000 and had it cleared for possible retail business location. The owner, James B. Barnett, agreed on the sale price of $56,000 for the lot. Quote, Once the purchase is final, we will have the lot rezoned commercial. I also have plans to speak to the owners of the next lot over to the south to see if they might have an interest in selling. If so, this will give us a good-sized piece in a desirable location, which would be great for a commercial business, she said. There are currently renters in the trailer home, therefore closing will take a month and a half to allow plenty of time for the renters to find other housing. In the final actionable item, a purchase order with Faulkner Consulting for the Monahans Fiber Loop for $10,000 was approved by the board. Quote, The extra $10,000 was for the editing and the rewrite of the grant for the fiber loop. This will complete his costs until we hear a yes or no answer on the grant, which should happen after the October 29th meeting, Adato said. COVID-19 cases remain low in Ward County. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Active cases of the COVID-19 virus in Ward County remains low, but has varied over the past few weeks in a range of none to about 6 to 10. As of Wednesday morning, there were 8 confirmed cases and 4 probable. Overall, there has been 159 confirmed cases, with 149 recovered and 2 deaths. There also has been a total of 68 probable cases, with 62 recovered and 1 death. A total of 1,099 tests have been administered in the county, with 4 pending. On Monday morning, an individual at Grand Falls Royalty ISD tested positive for the virus. As a precautionary measure, Superintendent Brett Starkweather ordered the school to be closed in order to sanitize the facilities. In a letter to the community on Tuesday, Starkweather said the school would reopen on Wednesday morning. However, remote learning would be available from October 21st to October 23rd for parents wishing to keep their students at home. In a similar vein, a notice went out on Monday from MWP ISD about a person who tested positive having been present at Tatum Elementary on Friday. Those who may have had close contact with this person will be contacted by the district. County Judge Greg Holly said, quote, "At this point, we've had positive cases in all 3 districts in the county. Every case is unique, and the response is dictated by the specific facts of that situation. We appreciate the efforts of each of our school districts to hold down the spread and protect our communities." End quote. Trustees approved tax roll for 2020. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The tax roll for Monahans Wicket Pyote ISD, as presented by Ward County Tax Assessor Collector Vicki Heflin, was approved in Monday's meeting of the Board of Trustees. The total 2020 certified value for the school district is $3.2 billion. The maintenance and operation tax rate of 93 cents per $100 of valuation will produce a tax levy of $30.5 million. The interest and sinking rate of 29.5 cents will produce a tax levy of $9.7 million. The tax rates were approved by the trustees in their August meeting. The M&O taxes pay for the overall operation of the district, including salaries, insurance, food, maintenance, utilities. It is also from this fund from which the district will pay the recapture funds back to the state. The INS taxes pay for debt of the district, which includes the $140 million bond passed by voters in May 2019. All of those funds remain in the district, and none is sent to the state. District Superintendent Chad Smith provided the construction update to the trustees, as representatives from Park Hill, Smith, and Cooper were unable to attend the meeting. Construction of the high school will begin soon. The first steps will be soil testing to determine if additional compaction may be needed. The trustees met in a special session on October 12th and approved the guaranteed maximum price for additions and renovations of Monahans High School. In that meeting, architect Scott Reed with Park Hill Smith and Cooper said the final bids totaled $49.3 million. The bids included items that were upgrades over the initial specification at no extra charge for the Phase 1, 2, and 3 new construction. Those items included a campus-wide intercom system, new lighting in the competition gym, card readers for interior doors, and Cat 6A cabling in lieu of Cat 6. Reed said, quote, "Getting all of the bids took longer than expected because of the large number of bids received, but that is a good thing as prices went down," end quote. Smith told the trustees Monday night, quote, there is a delay in finishing the auditorium at Walker Junior High, as deliveries of lighting fixtures from China have been delayed because of COVID-19 issues. This is not the fault of Lee Lewis Construction, the architects, or the school. We are continuing to monitor this. End quote. Renovation actions at Tatum Elementary and Cullender Kindergarten are moving forward and are on schedule, he said. Also, Smith reported construction has started on the new elementary school and is expected to be completed by August 2022. An agreement with the law firm of Allison, Bass & McGee, LLP, to review possible school district boundaries as the result of the 2020 census was approved. Quote, "This is a requirement every 10 years when the census numbers are available. A change of more than plus or minus 3% would change the district boundaries. It is rare that a population change greater than 3% that would dictate a change," Smith said. Cost of the agreement was placed at $11,470. Smith presented the enrollment reports as of September 30th. Total enrollment was 2,166 students. Enrollment at each campus was Monahans High School, 598, Monahans Education Center, 9, Walker Junior High, 351, Sudirth Elementary, 520, Tatum Elementary, 506, and Cullender Kindergarten, 182. Quote, "We are seeing more students coming back to the classroom instead of online remote attendance. We now have 88% of students back in the classroom," Smith said. No classes in the elementary grades are over the state mandatory 22-to-1 student-to-teacher ratio, so there is no need for class size waivers at this time, Smith said. Trustees present were Quint Melius, Donna Garcia, Raymond Garcia, Joel Greiner, Nancy Upchurch, and Steve Fine. Trustee Bobby Almanza was not present. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on Thursday, October 22nd. Jesus Granado Garcia, age 80, of Monahans, passed away peacefully Friday, October 16th at his home. He was born January 19th, 1940, in Study Butte, Texas, to Matilda and Theodora Garcia. After graduating high school in Marathon, he started his career in the trucking industry. He married his wife Berta in Alpine, Texas, on March 14th, 1963. He worked for Southwest Marketers for many years, and then he continued his career with FINA. He is survived by his loving wife of 57 years, Berta, their two daughters, Sue Lynn Garcia of Monahans, Lisa and Martin Gonzalez of Monahans, Jennifer and Cody Jimenez of Monahans, and Paige and Garrett Neighbors of Midland. Surviving grandchildren include Matthew and Adrian Gonzalez of Odessa, Brody and Brazos Jimenez of Monahans, and Pearl Neighbors of Midland. He is also survived by his brother Porfirio and Lorenzo Garcia of Monahans and family friends Rusty and Jane Shaw. Jesus is preceded in death by his parents, also by an infant son, Jesse Garcia, and sisters Sarah, Dominga, Cruz, and Francisca. Visitation was held Tuesday, October 20th, at the Harkey Family Funeral Home. Rosary was held Tuesday, October 20th, at St. John's Catholic Church. Funeral service was held on Wednesday, October 21st, at St. John's Catholic Church, with burial following in Monahan Cemetery. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. George W. Finch, age 94, of Odessa, passed away Wednesday, October 14th, at his residence. He was born June 15th, 1926, in Carmi, Illinois, to the late Nanny and William Finch. Services will be held privately by the family.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.